Smith has asked me to remind you that this is today's talk is called The Blind Spot of Science.
I'm a little...
The Blind Spot of Science. But I had first to finish up last time before doing so and saying a little more about the cross of reality. I would like to ask, are there any questions? I think it was very profitable the way it went the last meeting that you were asking questions at the beginning. So please. Is that okay? No demand?
I was one of the attendants.
Well, all the more you should ask.
I have a question. I'm not here to try to find it, but I'm interested in to refer so frequently to the problem of schizoid society. And psychoanalysis and psychology only increases this rather than helps.
I think so. I brought a specimen of such gorilla psychology to you. So I'm trying to show you what they are doing. And I may remark for others, I think I went too fast. Last time I tried to say that it isn't that the society, the members of the society themselves are schizophrenic, but that the society is schizosomatic, the body politic, or the body of Christ, as it used to be called formerly by the church, is itself split. People move in departments, especially of course the scientists, they even call their existence departmentalized. So you can imagine what happens if the leading people are both of belonging to departments and knowing nothing of the other departments, and establishing a complete chaos of there's no department that leads the other or that is powered over the other as formerly divinity did or philosophy, that today you have every field of human endeavor split up into smaller and smaller units to tell the story of the professors of history. One was appointed for the Middle Ages that ended in 1500 and one began with the modern times that began in 1500 and an unfortunate Dr. Andes, Dr. Men, wrote a book on 1490 to 1510, and it couldn't be, you see, it could not be sent there, it couldn't be mine, not was competent. Any more? No, please, can you? To round out what I said last time, I would like to draw your attention to the fact that the scientists have evaded the possibility of seeing this enmeshment, this embedding of us in four different processes through time. I try to show you that the respiratory tract, the digestive tract, which I omitted for briefly said, the regenerative tract of our genital organs, that they represent different relations to time, to the moment, because before the act, we have to be attracted by the scent for the future. In the act, we are embedded, we are anxious, we are singing like children in the dark who go through the woods, and there we move in musical inside the process that is demanded from us and from our fellow men. In retrospect, once we are construed, once we are built up into some unity, like a church or like a college or like our own family home, we have the possibility of celebrating anniversaries. And as soon as we can repeat and have the feeling of recurrence, we have a quite a different organ to express this. That's our memory. Tradition is not based on anxious feeling, on expectations, but you celebrate a birthday, not the same way in which you undergo the birth. That's a very different attitude of the human soul, and you are just a different person, and you are able to celebrate your 25th anniversary. A bridegroom, as you know, on his wedding day, is a moron. He is trembling in his shoes. It's the worst day I've ever lived through in my life. I have a migraine. I don't know it. Bridegrooms never confess it. But I think it's the most awful day for a bridegroom. It's the night before the bride. Now, certainly that is not true 25 years later. There's no anxiety then in work. And then he said that in saying farewell to an act well done, to a process well finished, we can analyze it and can pay the bills. And we get out from this act to which we were summoned and which we underwent and which we now maintain. History is maintenance. Feelings, the lyrics of our life are feelings, it's emotional, but the beginning is imperative. That's very different from what people tell us to be the only reasonable approach, the objective one. And the great fallacy of our time is to begin with the objective instead of knowing that this always is the end of things. It's the axe, it's the dump, it's the city dump on which you dump your analysis. Then it's all over. Nobody can fall in love when he begins to be objective. No girl can be married objectively. And on this I have to say something more. In our body, there's an archaic organ which hasn't even received a decent name. It's called corpora quadrigemina. Corpora quadrigemina. Most of you have never heard of it. It's right here and holds out against the brain. All our modern scientists in the last 200 years have insisted, as I told you, that the senses that telegraph their impressions to us, you see, are just landing in this brain that is of the moment, that is in our mentality. But this archaic organ of these four little hills that's here in back of us, of the anatomy of the brain, seems to be created to hold out for the completion of those stimuli that by the calling out of a name are evoked in us. You cannot hear the name of your child that is in agony without trembling while you are telephoning to the doctor, while you are taking a taxi, while you are going to the hospital. There are many acts on which you have to use your reason, but all the time underneath there is this knowledge that a name has been called out and desires to be, you see, listened to and acted upon. It is this contrast for which obviously this archaic organ of the brain, the quadrigemina, folds are the distant. They serve as the polarity, the cry, the shout, you see, a deep feeling moves them and they may tremble for a whole life. I'm sure that Michael Faraday had his quadrigemina moved by his decision. You know, he was a valet of a great physicist, Mr. Davis, turned up to be the greatest physicist of the 19th century. And this command he has beautifully expressed in many of his writings, letters, and books, that this was his lifetime vocation. I don't have to tell you that any artist, any politician, any statesman, even, I think, Pat Nixon, have their archaic quadrigemina move to see if he wants her husband to become president. Everything else is subordinate to this. Now he's committed any rational or irrational acts in the process. These acts are under what you call the scrutiny of your brain. They are rational acts. But the passion that tells her, forces her, you see, to do this, that has to be preserved somewhere. And that must hold out against the little acts of the day and of the year and must live longer than the last election or the next election. It's a ruling passion, as we call it. That's quite a good expression. And strangely enough, this observation which any one of you can make, that you are somebody who then undertakes any number of acts to execute
that what you are or are meant to be. This has found no explanation by the anatomists. They have ruled, they tell us, or they try to tell us, persuade us, that everything moves on the same plane of today's stimulus and tomorrow's stimulus. Just watch your own steps. You know very well for the next year what you have to do. If you want to become a doctor, it takes 7 years, 8 years of preparation. Now, where are you with your mind in those moments? You undergo many different mentalities. You know exactly that you have to be supported by your bride for many years. So, as long as she does this, you obey her orders. And many other relations, social relations, are ruled by this. You're well known, you see, received order, this is what I have to complete. But to confuse the little rational, logical acts which we have to commit, you see, every day with this ruling passion, which holds out against all the disappointments, that makes you repeat certain steps, and they take the exam twice if you flunk in the first. That's never explained. It isn't my invention. Of course, a friend of mine who was a great doctor and who fled to the Caucasus from the Germans and who then wrote me letters from the Caucasus, from this Russian bathing resort after the last war between 46 and 49, I received his message, dear old friends. We had published together a book on Paracelsus, the great doctor of the Renaissance. And so he turned to me, and was very strange, the letters actually arrived from the Caucasus in this country. And that was more than he could expect. And it was filled with his theory about the polygenic. That's what he had to tell me. And carrying out some insights Paracelsus had. Who is much more modern than most doctors of the 19th century today are, because he knew this counterpoint, you see, this point and counterpoint. And he knew about the five causes that make us up, which I tried to explain to you before, at least of them. And Paracelsus has said the great word, which I recommend to all the ladies who are hysterical, that he has said every illness of men can stem from five different circuits, different spheres. You can never say because you have a cold, from which of these spheres you got it. It's the same with Earth. It's very profound. I only wanted to hint at this. And I thought I should tell you that there's also physical, anatomical evidence for what we hold, and it is not true that the rationalists have the facts on their side. They have neglected this fact that under a permanent and perpetual stimulus for a life decision, you see, the reason runs through all like a little mouse, you see, from one hole to the other, either tries to escape your commission, your duty, you see, or tries to find access to its fulfillment. But these little movements which the brain here harbors and which take place in the brain must not be confused with your destiny. Let's not be confused with your having heard the call and holding out. And I think those four quadrigemina pills, or corpora as they are called in the dictionary, is a strange impotence of naming them. These quadrigemina points are implanted, that's why they are called archaic, to preserve those deeper cries which our smell, our eye, our ear, and our sense of touch, the sensory nervous system, convey to us with such majesty and such power that they ring in our forever, you see, in us, and cannot be dismissed. And they create the bad conscience, so to speak, when we are not on the way of following out their orders, when we try to escape. This is all said only to counteract your feeling, perhaps, that I'm simply singing poetry. I think the facts are on my side. It is remarkable that it's the school of anatomy that has now prevailed in philosophy, so to speak, for 400 years, has never taken account of this possibility. You see that there is a polarity between the older archaic or the implanted earth, because we are humans and have to fulfill our destiny, and the little stimuli of everyday life, and we wake up and wait till we can go to sleep again. May I ask you now to look at the importance of this quadrilateral of our various systems. They are all of a different time length. The regenerative track obviously goes by generations. We fall in love and our love stays, you see, as long children can be born, and our potency and our relation to old and young resists. So we have one track that at least is 30 years long. The eye is of a glimpse, and today that's why people have lived so speedy, because they think if you have seen it, you see, you go to Italy, and you know the story of the lady who went to Venice and with her daughter, and you know it, of course. I'm sorry. Well, I can't tell a joke that's known. And in German, you know the time span for the eye is called Augenblick, what you call moment. And that's a very wide expression. What the eye embraces is the moment. But what your generative sense embraces is a generation. What your ear embraces, I would think, is a year week. The great commands of life dominate, I would say, not for life, for a generation, and not for the moment, but they might dominate 7 years, 10 years, 50 years perhaps. In a university, the character of the place changes every 15 years. It is twice as fast as the physical change. If you have visited a place 15 years ago, which is called Harvard or Heidelberg, don't think that it is the same place. It's one of the great illusions of our age, that you think there is something attached to UCLA that remains after 15 years. Nothing remains. It's a different place. If people only knew this, they wouldn't send their children always to the wrong schools. A school has a faster turnover mentally, you see, and partly so the words, you see, dynamic faster than a political decision to go in with the democracy, you see, or to fight slavery. Everybody knows when he embarks on such an undertaking that is far beyond his own lifetime, even. That's what I have said, the 30 years is really the minimum of anything important in political life. Emancipation, you see, or independence of this country, you see, you cannot expect that this can be fulfilled in less than a generation. And the important decisions of life, you see, will only be fulfilled by people who come after you. And if you cannot implant in them the eagerness to fulfill your task, nothing important can ever be achieved. You look at anything in this world, greatness of our master was, as you know, that he knew this and ended his life when he was probably 30 or 34 and left it to the apostles, because otherwise he couldn't have been understood. The greatness of the apostolic succession is that the apostles were the second half of the life of Jesus. They were not just the church, you see, that they were something between later the Church of Rome or the Church of Corinth and the law. They could, because they were able to look back at this and to see lived after his suffering, they could express in the, as you know it in the Gospels, as well as in the letters of Paul and Peter, they could express its meaning. And he, knowing this, is the only man who anticipated their lives and left it and trusted to them, you see, the saying what it all meant. He didn't himself. There you have a clear example that he impressed them by his physical walk through life with a decision to undertake something that would outlast their own physical existence. I have never understood why the church makes so little of this abdication of the Lord, you see, in favor of the apostles. That's his greatest act. That's real faith. He put himself into their hands and said, you will have to do it. Because only through this connection between his death and their preaching is there anything like Christianity left. It's this way in which, by which it came into this world. It is a very remarkable story and a very rational story. And if the people today think it is irrational, it's only because they have built up a psychology and a sociology in which the time of Jesus is completely separate from the next 30 years. The only right life of Jesus, if they would write the death of Jesus as it was meant to be written, you see, then they would understand that the Gospels and the letters of St. Paul simply carry out the act, you see, which he committed to their explanation and didn't try to explain himself. So I would, I hope still to be able one day to write just a book on the 12 first years of the church, because we know nothing about it. When the apostles lived in Jerusalem, you see, and the Gospel of St. Matthew was written. That's a great story, that people worship the Lord every day just in holding on to an event that had happened, you see, exposed to this political decision that worked in them. This must not be left unfinished, you see. The moment, the 30 years, I would insist the 15 years, of course 15, you know, is just to say something, and history is timeless. The ritual and any anniversary can be duplicated and multiplied. You can have the 50th anniversary, the 100th anniversary, nothing changes officially, so to speak. In retrospect, time stands still. Now, yes, last time I gave you four expressions, stands still, time. I gave names to this. I said man, in every moment, being involved in these four different circles of his activity, of his decisions, of his hopes, his fears, his expectations, also his faith, is for this reason to be considered as at the same time being ultravert, being retrovert, being introvert, and being extrovert. When we hear, we are embedded in the tones that flood through us. When we look, we are extrovert, we look at something outside of us. When we are thrown forward as the apostles, you can really call St. Paul an ultravert. Because what we call, this is a philosophical expression, transcendent, is not a good word, I think. It has the same meaning as ultravert. Beyond, more. Tomorrow is the important day. And here in time, in the past, of course, you have the retrovert. These expressions were preliminary. I must invite you, if I shall now today criticize science, invite you to look at the terms they use, the people who do not know that we hang in these four different spheres, who put our senses in as something rather dead or static, you see, into our brain and say, here I am and there's the world, and telegraphs to us smells and words and sounds and impressions through the eye or through touch. These strange people who call themselves reasonable, I've never found more irrational people than the so-called rationalists. I'll tell you later why. They speak of objectivity, as you know, and subjectivity. Now these are very thick words which I do not like to use too much myself, because in the 18th century the word subject meant object and the word object meant subject. And it's only for 700 years they had this meaning that what you call object, you see, was called subject. God was not an object of your praise, but it was a subject of your praise in the 18th century. It's a very recent usage which have led you to use or to abuse this term objectivity. And I think it is necessary for you to know this, that it is a very temporal thing, this word objectivity. And it means that people begin at the dead-end street and end there. To be objective means to deal with things in as far as they are dead. So an objective scientist must treat the universe as something that can be weighed and measured, and where you have quantity, you have depth. Dead things can be weighed and measured, living things cannot. You will never catch, say, anything reasonable about any one of us in this room, in as far as he is alive. You can describe it, you see, as weighing 5 tons, but only because he's doomed to die. Weight is dead weight. That's why people want to be slim. It is very strange that this incredible perversion has occurred, that people pride themselves of being objective. That means that they hate me, that they omit me from their worries, that they don't dream of me. If I am to be treated objectively, I don't count. Well, my answer is, they don't count. Why should I count people who try to live objectively? Let them be killed. Let them be executed. I don't care. They have said that they don't want to be loved by me, so I won't love them. This word objectivity and subjectivity, however, have reached such dimensions that before going over to the scientist's primary sin, or crime, or omission, or idiocy, I would invite you to use other terms yourself from now on, or more terms, that is, to include into your thinking not just the subjectivity of a singing girl who is in good spirits, or the objectivity of a mathematician, but also the tremendous jubilation of a man who finally knows what he has to do and who is projected into the future. The apostles were neither objective nor subjective, but they were projected into the future. Under the pressure of the crucifixion, there was nothing for them left but to carry out this command. Every one of you does the same. We are all projected when our task has to be considered as unfulfilled. This has nothing to do with objective and subjective. It's just in another dimension. It's in a dimension of yesterday and tomorrow. And you are only satisfied when you can go to bed and say, a little bit has been done. That yesterday, you see, is not all that is today visible, but there is already a beginning of tomorrow made. I do not understand how anybody who acts, and this is out of a practical nation here, full of activity, can ever have been satisfied to divide reality into subjective and objective. I know very little of subjective or objective. Subjective, usually, I have a bad mood. My digestion doesn't function. Then I'm subjective, that's what the people at least tell us, you see. And objective, I'm bothersome, I'm a bore. All objective people are boring. Because there's no contact. I'm not interested in mathematics or in zoology, but I'm very interested in a bird that is singing. That's very different. The other thing are for encyclopedias, for dictionaries. You have to know, of course, what to avoid. All the objective knowledge is exactly like the eye of the horse that wasn't given to the horse by its creator for seeing positively, but for avoiding obstacles. If you have ever ridden, you know that the horse is very poor in its eyesight. It sees very little. But it must see enough not to run into a wall, not to run into a fence. And this much is the first implication of seeing, that we can avoid obstacles. And I think if you would treat the eye today a little bit to its original meaning, that we must see in order not to run over a person when we drive a car, you would make very good use on your freeways of the sense of eye, of seeing. Seeing is avoiding collision. This is the first. All the other things are transformations of a rather artificial character. The Madonna is not the Madonna of Raphael in any deeper sense if you haven't first heard the story and you see, suffered with Christ and been initiated into the history of the church, then you can see the Madonna. Without it, it's just nothing. And our modern people who try to isolate the I sense cease to attain. There's no content. Abstract painting is not abstract painting, but it's objective painting. Again, this fantastic attempt to begin with seeing, without sympathy, without fright, without impression. It can't go, won't last long. At this moment, it seems that nobody has any commission for the future, and nobody hears any commands, and nobody has any story to draw on, and therefore, what else can the painter do? He is, I think, genuine today in insisting that he is deprived of the relationships to the other senses. That's very serious, and painting must be, all the senses must be trained, but you must see that we are in a complete destruction of the unity of our five senses because of the sermon in the valley. The last sense term which I would like to introduce, therefore, is tragic. Anybody who is today an American citizen or cherishes Western civilization or looks back to the history of science or thought or religious church history has been transferred from generation to generation until you here are sitting. And in you, obviously, we are here in St. Augustine by the Sea, even antiquity, even the time before our own era, you see, is represented. And so any human being that speaks to anybody else in a civilized language, which has existed now for so long, of course, is trajected, transferred. You know what a traject is, as a ferry. He has been ferried across the River Styx 1,000 times, because the people who have formed those words and those expressions which you and I use daily, you see, of course, have all died, and yet they have been, you see, their labors have been transmitted to us that we can feel that we are more than ourselves. This is very important for all of you who have to teach the children or students, that a teacher never only speaks out of his own generation to the child of the next generation. His authority is based on this power to connect all times and condense them into a talk, you see, of the living generation to the next. This is his dignity. If he doesn't do this, he only teaches his own nonsense. It isn't worth anything. He has no right to teach then. He's just an individual. He must draw on the wisdom of the ages. And on the other hand, you also see the immediate consequences that he must treat his student as the protagonist of the whole future of mankind. You may train a boy for tennis in his own body for the moment, but you can instruct a man for being a technician and a plumber, but you cannot teach a man only for his own lifetime. You must teach people so that even against their will and without their understanding, they carry something to the next generation. Very many people are like Isaac. He was a very big brother, as you know, and was perfectly sufficient that Abraham's teacher reached through Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. They are only the successors, but Isaac had to be there, you see, opening up to future generations what had been left behind. I think he had no power. He had just an experience. He had to speak of his father because he was miraculously saved. You see, his own execution didn't take place. And you will always, therefore, have to scrutinize the modern educational methods, which always begin with the child and end with the child. The child that receives an education is very unimportant, as unimportant as the teacher is. But today I have to say a good word for the teachers, because in our schools in this country, I think, it's a slave. They are slaves, these teachers, because they are made, told that they are there for the happiness of the children. Perhaps the parents are, I don't know this. The teachers certainly are not there for the happiness of these children. Make them unhappy if it helps. You can't tell. Some people, children have to be made unhappy, some they have to be happy, and then alternates. But I don't see why happiness of the child has anything to do with education or teaching. There has been a great story and it mustn't be forgotten. And who willy-nilly these children must be told so that they have enough shame and enough reverence that they tell their children and don't call their children I'm a hog and you are a hog, but give them a decent name. For example, Mr. Hog obviously had just a school teacher who made him happy. And so his happiness, you see, outran all bounds. This is incredible, this theory of education. What has education to do with the living of the next generation? It is the missing link, the tie between the whole history of the past and the whole future of the human race. And these two very feeble links in between the teacher and the student, you see, and of this movement, cannot understand what they are doing if they think they learn for themselves. You know this expression which has driven me crazy here in my college here in America, that the student has the right to say, didn't get anything out of it. He has the right to get anything out of it. He has to put himself into it. That's all. And if he can't, he's just a poor student. But the idea that he should get something out of it is absolutely foreign to the process of teaching. Has nothing to do with teaching. It's a complete capitulation to the jukebox. Where you throw 10 cents in to be entertained. But entertainment is certainly not education. I'm very serious. I feel that the only revolution due in this country is a revolt of the teacher of the drama schools. Because they are slaves to the alleged happiness of the children, and so every year the children are more unhappy. A child is only happy when it can forget itself into some bigger task. The rest is all nonsense. Look how they play. They all want to be different. No child that is really devoted to play wants to play itself. It wants to forget itself. They play marriage, they play soldiers. They play something that takes them far afield outside of their impossible self. All our selves are impossible. They smell, but not attractive.
So, would you therefore understand why I insist that the church, the family, the poets, the artists will remain mutilated, paralyzed, as long as they receive this still stultifying vocabulary from the scientists that divides the reality into object and subject? For a person who has to live daily, he himself is a project, a miracle through time, you see, finds himself at a certain point in time, 1962, and has great trouble to find ways and means to elicit some hopes and some expectations for the year 2050. But that would be the minimum of any educational effort, for example.
But do I care for this moment? And as soon as you use these terms, project and tragic, you suddenly understand the crisis of today. The dialectics, as the Marxians call it, the logic, as the secular mind calls it, is unable to realize this quadrilateral of our truly and true existence. These four centers, which I have tried to make important for your thinking, are so important because they take you outside this logical twist that there's only A and non-A, B and non-B, or A and B. That's not real life, that's timeless life. That's a life purely in space. The real life of all of us, and now let us begin with and come over to the blind spot of science. Real life is invisible to the scientist because he cannot assume that not everything can be made simultaneous. The fiction of science is that we can know everything at the same time in an ideal end stage, because all the truth is available. Now I try to show you that a man who is attracted, or a woman who attracts, that a musician who fiddles and a listener who hears his music, that a historian who looks back to we, to the flight across the ocean of the founding of the founding fathers and the founding fathers themselves, that these people cannot be realized at the same time. You open your Bible and you can understand one fourth of it perhaps at a happy day, and the next time you open the Bible you can understand it by another chapter and other writer. It is a lie that anyone at any one day can understand the whole Bible. That's a fiction of science. I understand these things very often not at all, and I have to wait a few years until I do understand. This is the same with any Shakespeare play, it's the same with Homer, and if people would only admit it, they would be very happy, because they would know that our mind doesn't work simultaneously, because we undergo mentalities, and not every mentality in our various moods and our various situations opens up to what is to be found there. You would have to see that the Bible is written lyrically, dramatically, epically, and analytically, I mean in the books of wisdom, for example. And obviously we are not in a full understanding of all these four states at the same time. When you have deep feelings, you see, you cannot understand complicated logical processes, and on the other hand, when you are a logician, then woe to your wife. He will not understand her lyrical mood at this moment. It's very strange that the fiction exists today that we can know everything at the same time. And that's a curse. And that's a blind spot of science, on which I now have to ask you to follow me a little more precisely. Anybody who reduces knowledge to a timeless somewhere, to a true mind, to an eternal mind, or what you call reason, abstracts us from our real experience. Our real experience says that at any one time I live at a different front. You see, forward, inward, outward, backward. And you all can test this. The family is given us to realize it even externally. The daughter is on the forward front, the son is in the inner front with his new thought, his mercurial thoughts, the mother is at the backward front for the dignity of the home, and the father is on the outer front to keep out the enemy and to look for the wherewithal on the material front. The son is the idealist, the father is the materialist, the mother is the historian, and the ceremonious person, I mean, she says how any family celebration shall be held. That's dignity, but that's also tradition. And the daughter, with her attractive beauty, changes the whole aspect, brings a new man into the home, and she marries. And that is, she renews life. In these four people, you have a kind of example of how the human mind is beautifully distributed. And in bride and bridegroom, you have the pair that therefore is spoken so vividly of in the Bible, who unite these four extreme polarities. Daughter, mother, son, and father, they all meet in bride and bridegroom. And that's why the human soul is the bride and the word is the bridegroom. And that's why Jesus is called 16 times in the Old Testament the bridegroom, because he allows us to be transformed from any one of these stages into all the others. You see, he has created an open access to all these four fronts of life. The scientist cannot neither see this human family as a necessary distribution, a division of labor, so that no one of us is a whole man, you see, but always needs his, how do you call it, implementation by the three other types of the human family. But the scientists can therefore not discover the existence of the human soul. For all psychologists today, mind and soul are identical. They call this psychology. famous, most famous textbook on psychology in this century, written by William James, begins with the incredible sentence, the blasphemous sentence, psychology is the science of the mental processes. You understand? If my mental processes, which change every day, you see, from these various fronts of existence, you see, to another, where I can write poetry and solve equations, you see, and vote in an election, you see, and read a chronicle. Since they are all made one by the scientists, the mind is open. One mind, you see, and they even dream that my child should have the same mind as myself, and I'm so pleased that it has quite a different mind. This idiocy, one mind for all men, is, as you know, the curse of our age. You try to give it. I had a case, my friend is a psychiatrist, and to him came parents who had ruined their child for their musical, and they insisted that the baby was 1.5 years and 1.5 years old when they started this crucifixion, and had to know the names of the composers whose music this child listened to. And by 3, it was a laboratory, and they have never recovered. They have been able to destroy this child in their adoration of the one mind mentality. And that's quite usual. I read today in the paper, in this Los Angeles Times, that a 13.5-year-old boy was allowed to finish his freshman year at UCLA. Shame over you. This man must go crazy. It's not allowed to change the ages of a human being in such tyrannical measure. All the IBMs, you see, only due to the fact that the boy was allowed to go to Harvard at 14 and to graduate at 17. Then he invented, of course, a child's mind, a child's machine.
Obviously, this is true.
That's what the business computer is about the mentality of a child. And you know even the man's name. I know him too. Or it too. The giant mind today is the destroyer of nations, of whole peoples, and also of the peace of the world. They can't sleep, the people who have only a mind. The soul is something quite different. The soul is the power in us that can bury mentality. The freedom of all of you consists in this fact that at any one moment you actually do decide, everybody does it who is healthy, you see. You can dismiss in the evening all your worries and go to sleep. And nobody who can do this, you see, is a human being. And this dismissal of the state of mind in which you were the day before, you see, is a condition of your survival. So unimportant is the mind. The mind is of the day.
But to be right mind, not just the M is a capital letter, but I and N and D are too. It's a very small thing. The human soul is denied by the scientist. Mind and soul coincide. They have therefore a strange science called psychology, which is, as you see, a science without its object, the soul. Psychology means soul, you see. But it's quite an achievement for all these psychologists to deal with something they deny like this. And they literally do deny it. They call it now the subconscious, you know, to make it into something smiling. But the soul is very noble, and it is not just unconscious, but it is better than consciousness. It's the power to change your consciousness. What is consciousness? I told you last time, I think, I'm not conscious while I'm talking here, I'm trying to tell you something that's important. And in order to say it with conviction, I have to be quite unconscious. If I'm self-conscious, I begin to stammer and forgot what I wanted to say the next minute. Here I have an example of this gorilla psychology. They make us into gorillas, that is, in people who have no deal with future or past, who are of the moment. It's quite serious. This is a book on contemporary theories and systems in psychology, and the man quotes, it's a quotation, "Semantically, death is a misleading term, since no such thing as death ever existed." Quite an achievement. So, sorry, the man isn't here. He could turn his, twist his neck. This I wanted to read to you. Such nonsense can be printed in such fat volumes. Semantically, death is a misleading term, since no such thing as death ever existed. The name death does not contain any designates, nor does it represent any object, function, or state, or any category, class, or system of object, functions, or states. Actually, one cannot make logical statements about death, because the only meaning of death is non-existence, not life. Life includes a variety of phenomena. Death does not include any. Life means is, death means is not. So, that doesn't exist. Well, it's natural that you should have the loved ones in Los Angeles, because they in the temple to deny that death exists. And this is the, as you know, the power of persuasion which science has gotten over the populace, that people repeat this and eliminate death from their thinking while it is dominating everything we do. I mean, you can't build up a trust for your children, you can't make a will, you cannot decide that your children's child should move into another country, you see that the future, it looks brighter, you cannot emigrate from Italy to the United States, for example, or from Sicily, if you do not hope that something shall survive your death. Most people whose lives I observe do all their reasonable and important acts only from fear of death. So this man, who calls himself a psychologist, you see, bases his statement that death is not in existence on this gorilla fact, that the gorilla does not know where he came from and where he's going. He's of the moment, you see. The gorilla cannot look beyond his grave or before his parents' grave. But that's why he cannot think. That's why he has not this freedom of undergoing several mentalities and switch to various means of understanding. Here he has to understand the mountain, there he has to understand the flood, here he has to understand his neighbor. We can. We know how to cope with living beings, our brothers. We know how to obey the divine powers, and we also know how to use commodities, things. You see, I try to show you that words, numbers, and names, you see, convey to every one of us this tremendous Trinitarian power, you see, that in relation to our maker, in relation to our comrades in arms, and in relation to the dead things around us, we use very different language and we use different means of exploiting or employing or obeying to them. So this exaggerated sense of objectivity, which leads to the picture journals today and to the movies and to the attempt to make religion the verbal factor of men into manufacture of men. We are created by the word, because the word enables us to change, as I tried to show you, even in the grammar of a word, you see. There is an imperative, and there is a subjunctive, and there is an historical tense, and there is the infinitive and the participle, which says it's consummatum esse. So it has all been done. Now let's look at it. Since we are able to do just what the gorilla does not do, it is only decent to say that we owe this to our prescience of death. Because we know we die, everything sends us around the ways and means in which we can celebrate victory over this. That's why death is the cornerstone of our existence. Man is not an animal because he knows in advance of his death. And accordingly, all virtue, all asceticism, is the shelving of your momentary passions, you see, in favor of those who are needed to continue the work of creation in general and for the whole. Every one of us is asked to forego certain pricks of your senses, of some sensuousness. Nobody
who would indulge for one day to anything his sense of sight suggests could survive. He becomes obviously a wave of the society. Either it's drinking, becomes a drunkard or a drug addict, or he ends in a brothel as a lecherous person, or he will go bankrupt because he spends too much. Not one of our actions in life can be reasonably computed and organized without this respect for death. Death is omnipresent, you may know it or not. And of course, as I try to show you, it's not death at the end of life, but it's the death of being a child, it's the death of being an adolescent, it's the death of being in California and moving elsewhere. We bury our dead constantly, and the more often we do it, the more we have life. Why did St. John live to be 90? Because he was present at the cross, at the crucifixion of his Lord, and took the death of Jesus deep into his heart. Anybody who faces death in time can live long, because we must die partially very often. And then you have a long life, and life everlasting. And the people who want to live long don't live at all, because they do not dare in the meantime to die to the stages of their existence, as we all must. Look at all the mothers-in-law and this misfortune you see that it brings when they cannot die to their motherhood. I heard a fine story yesterday, where I quoted. My hostess yesterday told me that when her child was born, her mother said she wouldn't interfere with the child's education, but she wanted to say only one sentence. Your child, you only have 18 years, but your husband you have forever. Make this the law of your behavior. You think you can't go wrong. This means that after 18, on the wedding day, there must be some death, voluntarily, you see, accepted. If not, a crisis on the hand and all end as an analyst.
Yeah, obviously, that's what happens. Most people who go to the analyst cannot bury their dead in time. And we have to bury many things in during our life. The whole problem for everyone in the human being is to decide what is mortal and what is eternal. But that's not our business. And certainly the relation of parents and children, you can become grandparents. But in order to become real grandparents, I assure you, you have to cease to be parents. For a while you are just not parents, and then you become grandparents. And then you are very much in demand. Isn't this true?
Too true.
What I try to say is, I think, of primary importance. Every act or process that the divine creator expects us to perform, peace among men, the building, the settling of the cultivated area, the bringing up of animals or of children, the building of schools, whatever we do, and with the knowledge that this is what we are expected to do, runs through this gamut of command, of getting involved, of looking back and holding on and fast to it, and of saying one day it's all over. And life, therefore, is not so much our own physical death at any one given moment, but our respect for this cycle, that every where we undergo and understand a will higher than ours, we have to take the pain of loss upon us. You cannot gain without this loss. Nobody can tell you when the Lord says it's over with. I didn't know that I would have to leave my country where I was at the age of 45. I already had become quite a vain man because I was the special article in the encyclopedia of my country now. Anybody who's in the Encyclopedia Britannica thinks he's arrived, and the next thing is a peerage. And but my story only began. And so it was compressed, so to speak, in half a generation, in half a life, what usually would be extended to a longer life. All these things are for everybody. And I think in America, it is even this cutting your losses is very common. I think people know this and do it. But it's done, strangely enough, without any relation to their mental philosophy. The scientist has completely ruined their thinking about this cutting your losses, this moving away from other places, this alibi, I mean, this saying it's all over. I find the American males in a tremendous tension between his innumerable locations, his innumerable positions in life, his willingness to change, and this exile of death from his mind. That death must never be mentioned because it occurs constantly. I don't know, there must be some religion. And no European dies so often to the things he has created, to the positions he has held, to the achievements he can muster, you see, and no European who wouldn't complain and feel miserable. Yet, when it comes to the general statement of fact, what this means, you see, that death is in us, with us, amidst among us, he has a complete repulsion and reversion. People don't mention it. Death doesn't exist. It does exist. It exists as much as life. It's like breathing in and breathing out. Nobody can live who cannot die. And the more we voluntarily die to those deadening circumstances, the more can we hope to save life for another chapter in our existence. Well, I think you all act upon this, but it's very strange that you allow the scientists to tell you, as this gorilla does, that death doesn't exist. It exists as much as life exists. It's a condition of life. No life that is not, you see, condemned to die. And that's the meaning of the cross of Jesus. He really died. His resurrection is not dying. And it is infamous when D.H. Lawrence wrote a book, you see, in which he described how Jesus escaped death. I don't know if you know this book. I think the greatest blasphemy ever perpetrated in the history of Christianity. In his dying day, D.H. Lawrence, who didn't want to die, and had always only described vitality and life and being vital and so on, wrote a book, Manual 27, I think it's only here. Do you know it? Mm-hmm. Well, how is it called?
Escaped Cock is one title.
Eh?
The Escaped Cock.
The Man Who Died.
Well, I think it shows you, I mean, I hold the clergy responsible for this total misunderstanding. The poor man, of course, had never seen a church after his 15-year problem, you see. And up to that time, the resurrection was misunderstood for not dying. Now, this brings up one more important point. The scientists cannot understand that children, that people who have not been visited by vital command, as in this quadrigemina organ can happen, that have not fallen in love, who have not made a vow, cannot understand the divine truth. There will always have to be two languages for the ultimate truth of our life, for religion, for children and for and all the attempts of the last century have been directed as though the child of 7 or 8 or 10 or 12 could be told. It can be hinted at. It can be promised that one day it will understand. But woe to the church that tries to teach only things that children can understand. That is impossible. And it is not meant to be, because the senses of these children have not been realized. They have not gone through such movements of the soul. They cannot love. You cannot tell a 7-year-old child what love is, or what sex is. Before, they are capable of loving. Now our children, 14 also, they know sex, but they don't know what love is. So men must first learn what it means to promise and to stand by his word. As long as he's just running, how can he matter? It's impossible. So it must break down. This is, I think, the greatest curse of the scientific mentality, that they say that anybody who has a mind at all must have a scientific mentality, and therefore there is no such thing as preparation and as gradual understanding. There are no secrets that must become known, and they poke fun at our favorite term of old, revelation. and they can't understand it. They say nothing has to be revealed. Well, if you don't feel that the veil is before our eyes, I'm very sorry. As I told you, many a time I open the Bible and it's perfectly ununderstandable to me. I have a veil before my eyes, and by an act of grace, a day later, I may understand it better than anybody who has ever read the Bible. Because we all change between moments of ecstasy and megalomania and moments of humiliation and cleanliness and blindness or deafness. I think this is the most important handicap today for any spread of spiritual unity among mankind. It's a wrong monism, a wrong idea of democracy, that everyone can understand everything. This is simply not true. And as long as you hold to this, you will have mob rule, and it will spread. And that's the mob. The mob is the demons, the people who are corrupted by the heresy that everyone can understand everything at any all the time. We don't. I don't. Sir. You don't. And anybody who admits this knows that from the hands of the impure hands of the non-understanders, you see, the truth has to be saved, has to be protected. You cannot entrust everybody with the truth, since we all have in our lives, three quarters of the time, not the ability to understand it, and to turn it, and to protect it. We run away from it, we sacrifice, we say it's ununderstandable, I know nothing about it. And the special case, of course, is with the young child. With regard to love, I think the whole 19th century, the century of the child as it has been called, as you know, was naive in this respect, that they thought, if only all the great truth is told to the children, then mankind is saved. Then it perishes. It's the end of the world. This is the hardest doctrine, I know, to consume, and because people feel it may be true what I say here, but how can I say this to anybody else without being called a reactionary? I'm sorry, but it is. The truth must come out. You know it as well as I, that this is a fact. And I think you can convey this message to everyone when you say it of yourself. When we begin to admit that we move through these various spheres of understanding, and then I want to see the universe, I know very little of what it's all about. When I am obedient, I understand a little more. When I go into history, I understand still more. And when I obey the next command, I suddenly understand that the whole world was created by commands of the same character. Again, I think the church has been very negligent in this respect to oppose the scientists. You know, there has been biblical criticism, there has been church history, but nobody has told me, I have to rediscover myself, my generation has to rediscover, that in the days of Samuel and Saul and David and Solomon, the Bible was written. In retrospect, and these good people, Hannah, the mother of Samuel, who had no child, who was barren, and implored the Lord, and was given a child, and she's dedicated to him, is obviously the starting point for the whole Bible story. And what did these Israelites say to themselves? They hadn't existed when the world was created. They didn't want to write fairy tales. But they said, as we have experienced the mercy of God, and our prayer has been fulfilled, so the world must have come, everything in the world must have been created in the same manner. Why, you, we people today, as the Nazis, you see, try to breed people as cattle. The biblical tradition says, we have been created by love and obedience and prayer, so the world has been created in the same way. That is, you can apply your experience of life to the rest of the world, you see, and say it has been always the same way. That's biblical, the biblical principle. To go back and say, God said to the life, be there, and it was life, just as Hannah was told, you will be this child, and she was this child. This is one method that is a faithful, the method of faith. And the scientific method says, I go to the farthest electron, and then I deduce myself. And here I come to the second expression of the blind spot of science. If you try to breed children as we breed cattle, you see, then you follow the science principle that goes from the most remote, smallest entity, most far away from you, you see. and tries to rule your life not from your experiences, but from these deductions from far away, from Mr. Niels Bohr or from Mr. Einstein or something like that. These people, this scientific theory has only one little fault. Mr. De Boer and Mr. Einstein are winners. Christianity today, in the eyes of science, is only represented by the scientists. They are the real McCoy. They are the real guys. They can talk of electrons, you see. And they are living for the future of science. It's the only point in the scientific heaven where the future is not the result of the past. Every scientist of any greatness, of any genius, is a man who knows everything that people have known before, dismisses it with a shrug of the shoulder, and says, you have to start all over again. This was done by Planck, and he said, all the theory of gradual, you see, graduation of graduality must go, there are quanta in reality, you see, which nobody has seen so far, but they are just there, they are creatures. And don't allow your children to say when they are 13 and look up the Encyclopedia Britannica that they are in research. Research is a very religious word, and a very important word, but it has fallen among the dogs, and among the scientists, and among the psychologists. Rescue it. Research means that man is free to stand at the end of a line of knowers and to say this knowledge isn't good enough. And to resist the whole burn, you see, of tradition and to defy the authorities and to go against their sacred word and say this is all wrong. I found out differently. I know we pay so much for research that the people, of course, in order to get the funds, only discover things that can be known beforehand. I despise this situation. This country is not yet secure against the total stagnation of its industry and its discoveries when you go on in bribing the young with money. Pardon me, Mr. Boylan, but that's very serious. So far, for 300 years, scientific research has Christianized the universe, that is, has thrown it away from God and from witches and from evil spirits, and has made it a beautiful whole. As long as there have been scientists who defy the tradition of their science, that is not a, no, there is no continuum in the research, but there's a break as the condition for your right to end it. You see, to interrupt the thinking as hitherto, obviously, is in the fact that you have suffered patiently in filling you with the knowledge hitherto acquired. A scientist must be able, and here I come back to my central theme, he must die to his own best knowledge and to the knowledge of his time. And he, there must be a seed of faith, a grain of faith, in which he said, although all the authorities say this, I cannot help feeling that I must enter a new, usher in a new day, a new dawn, a new life. What is totally overlooked by these foundations and by the young who are now attracted by the money available in research is the danger, the risk, that they have to stick their neck out and to say something that is not approved by the authorities, that goes against the tradition. And only those truths are important. The other is almost just technology. And in this country, as you well know, technology is mistaken for science. Technology, the carrying out of good cameras because you have learned optics. That's one thing. But science is something quite different. Science is the courage to die to your knowledge or to let this knowledge fall to the ground. And when Copernicus said, or Galilei, that the earth was turning around the sun, they knew everything anybody had ever written about the movement of the sky, in the sky, you see? And then said it isn't good enough. That is, a young person cannot be in research because he has to search first for what is already known. At 14, the child has to know what people have, other people have said. And if you stumble on a discovery, that's not research. That may happen, I mean, I would not deny it, but
pardon me when I seem to be down on the children, but they have been spoiled in our reasoning processes, you see. They have been admitted to the inner court of justice, of mercy, of wisdom, where they don't belong. Therefore, science has this blind spot that the scientist is a courageous man, a man under God who dares the community, who is not a conformist, and who dares to stand alone. If you think of the great scientists in the 19th century, to Semmelweis, who discovered the puerperal fever, you see, and saved millions of women, you see, from certain death. He was persecuted, he was put in a lunatic asylum just because he was right. Now, you may say we abolish this, we adore research. I doubt it. Real research will always appear dangerous. And if it is not dangerous, it is not a branch of the life of the church. But it is. To me, the natural sciences are just the next step to Christianize the universe. And after the fathers of the church and after the scholastics, you see, came this era of the last 400 years in which the world was freed from incubus and succubus and witches, and that's the first step. But it was connected, as you know, with great trials and troubles for the men who discovered it. And that as it should be. Why do we tear apart the history of the martyrs of the church and the history of these martyrs of truth? It is a limited field. The world, of course, of things is a negative to men, because it's the world of the dead things. The stars are not alive. But if you do not investigate their movements as mathematically proven, they might again become gods, and you might have the astrological column in the Los Angeles Times. Well, all these things, if not achieved in one direction, you see, will always take you back in the opposite direction. And pre-Christian superstitions loom very largely among us today. And I think in Los Angeles you have a good cross-section. I think you could just write Encyclopedia Americana from collecting the evidence here. And you wouldn't have to go outside Los Angeles. 6 million people and 10 million superstitions. I mean it. It's very true. And if they wouldn't be guided and held up by the rest of the world, they would indulge in this, you see, and all become oranges. It is very tempting. Any small part of the mankind is constantly in danger of doing versus. And I think the scientists are exactly in this group today that is absolutely superstitious. It has abolished the distinction between mind and soul without ever investigating whether a mother shall ever talk like a father, or a daughter ever shall talk like a son. They shall not. To the end of the world, a bride must talk differently from her mother and from her little sister. It would be terrible if everyone's mind contained the same equations. Every man who lives in the future has to say, who and who is for? Not at all, not for me. So this so-called scientific truth today has become a hindrance to living. Death has been abolished by these scientists. And now comes the climax, the last thing I would like to say today. Would you bear with me? Is it too much? I'm always overstepping my rights, I know. There is no present in the world of science. It's a fiction. You speak of the present state of affairs according to which a cancer has to be operated. Cancer of the breast has to be operated. A doctor is obliged to do this under the code of his profession. And he uses the term, today we do this. Perhaps tomorrow we have found a way where we decide not to do it. What is this today? In reality, in the outer world, outside of you and me, today doesn't exist. The present doesn't exist. And it's only if you observe the facts in the external world, there's only yesterday and tomorrow. As Homer calls it, it's a razor blade edge, you see, that divides yesterday and tomorrow. Today, or the present, which we all need here, in our presence here, you gave me kindly now already 1 hour and a half, and this is one moment in time, and it oversteps the visible dial of digit of the clock. 1 hour and a half we have been transforming into a present moment. And you see that I can prove this to you, because at the end of these 1 hour and a half, I'm still able to convert or to retroact anything I have said in the beginning. I could now come out and say, you must misunderstand what I said an hour ago, you see. And as long as we are here in our confidence, in our room together, and the newspapers have reported myself, I'm perfectly free to contradict myself, to explain, to convey. Man has the divine power to bring time to a standstill, to the eternal presence, or the divine presence. This is a miracle. Now, all sciences do this. They have a today, which is set off against yesterday's results and tomorrow's hopes. And they meet in their conferences, and during this conference, the time stands still. We only, and only the human soul, can create a presence. We call this, with a more political expression, we can create peace. Where two people are not animals that are greedy for food, but sit together at a common meal, you don't begrudge your husband the best food. Wherever this happens, where a meal is taken together, some artificial, historical, religious creation has taken place. Have you ever thought that animals cannot do this? That any animal will try to get at the food of the neighbor? You cannot feed two horses without risking this. Domesticated animals may do differently, or the mother and her cubs. But I once attended a CCC camp meal in which the morale had sunk so low that these boys, they were 18 to 22, grabbed the food from each other. And the educational officer in this camp said, you see, they are like dogs. They're fallen so low, there's not even the morale, you see, that they can have a meal together. You remember that Mr. Meyer asked me about the fifth sense, the taste. And I didn't like at that moment to go into this secret of the taste. Our four tracts of which I have spoken, you see, are all drawn together in this most momentary, the digestive tract. When we eat together, a tremendous creation takes place. We taste together the same food, and that's the ultimate peace you can establish between people. Not when they think alike, not when they speak alike, you see, but when they are so one that what one, you see, receives is received by the other. That's a great miracle. Doesn't exist in the animal kingdom. And as you know, the church has been built on this very simple ritual that all, you see, are glad that the other fellow can take participate. Participation is the secret of this creative peace through which, wherever peace exists, it's the creation of a power higher than you or my will. You cannot create peace, I cannot create peace, you see. It can only happen when a third power is present. You can have peace in the name of your profession, you can have peace in the name of your country. The highest peace, obviously, is in the name of God, because any enemy, and you can participate in this peace. And it is, strangely enough, the most realistic, the digestive, and the most short-lived tract in our existence, you see, which points to this completion of all the other senses in one great act of reconciliation. I only wanted to say that I didn't omit taste, but as you can imagine, for good reason, I didn't want to prostitute it too early. At this point, I think I may say I've done enough, but all I can do today.
May I ask one question? This phrase of the four senses come together, does that begin the very beginning when you're born? Does that develop?
They always exist. It's in every human brain. The primigenia corpora, as they are called. They are called in anatomy an archaic organ, that is an organ that seems not to have undergone any development. Why should it? Not to develop.